threw that in and he's only making about the Aernak Enterprise only gave him $50-$60 a week. There wasn't any big, so he, to get an end at all, he just committed suicide. That was what he did. He committed suicide.
Well, there is all my manuscripts. I couldn't play it. I didn't want to
finish it up, but his son ran the paper for a little while. But about 3 weeks later, the Independent, or the Enterprise office, for my manuscripts went up. This office was right here where the IGA store is, right? It's being built right now. There's no IGA store down here. That's where the old printing office was, where we used to edit the Audrey Enterprise. I helped him with that, although we had another man, Alf Jennings and so on, that helped. But as I said, he had the command of English. I never saw anyone that had the English language. He was giving me one example. He said of each one, when he was working for the New York paper, they tried to outdo one another. And he said it was St. Patrick's Day, or it was coming, and they'd sent some shamrocks from Ireland, and they said there was in there, so he asked one of the girls there, he's a young man then, if he could take her out that night. And all she said, I'm tangible. Well, he wasn't quite up to it. He says he didn't know whether she had accepted him or rejected him. So he had to skirmish around without them knowing and take a half an hour so to get the largest dictionary to get the finer meaning of the word to find out that she had really accepted him. But each one was trying to outdo the other by using words like that. I know one day I looked out the window, well, I said, there are quite a few people in town today. I said, don't understand you, you can't talk English, you don't need to talk to me. I didn't know what he meant. He says, there can't be anything such as quite a few. He says, a few means not many, and there can't be a quite a not many people in town. That's the way he'd take you up on that. Then somebody took him up on, said they'd made a grammatical error. Can't be, it can't vary, it's impossible, he's just eccentric, you know. It can't be a grammatical error. If it's grammatical, it's perfect. It can't be, there may be an error in grammar, but not a grammatical error. He'd always take you up on things like that. Well, then later on, this is when we first started that, he was just as apiece to in running this little printing office, and I was under-sheriff of the county. And I lived up here in the Delnaw settlement. And at that time, International Harvester Company had come out with one of those hard rubber-tired single-cylinder trucks, chain drives. Maybe you've seen them. I don't know, maybe you've seen them. You wouldn't see them now, but you could see them probably at Greenfield Village. But anyhow, that's what they used, great big tall wheels with hard rubber tires on it. And I was bringing a load of cream. This was Saturday afternoon. And it was the 17th of March. I was bringing, there was a train that used to come in here every day, and taking this load of cream for the merchant up there down here. And just as I rounded the corner here in Audrey, why, I could see there was about 60 men fighting at once. I never saw, it was a free-for-all right.
Which year was this?
This would be along about 1914, I think, somewhere along there, about 1914. But anyhow, the Irish and Scots were the old original settlers in here. There were lots of Irish and Scots. But when they started to raise sugar beets, the Germans came here. Hundreds of Germans, they were husky men. Well, being it was St. Patrick's Day and it was a little bit rainy, they'd been drinking, and this was a little afternoon, and by that time they were feeling pretty good, but they don't know how it is, but at least the Scots and the Irish were getting hell pounded out of them by the Germans. That was about the size of it. Because I know that no Scotsman or Irishman would ever ask a deputy sheriff to intervene unless he was getting pretty badly pounded up. So Danny McLean said, Ennis, come and do your duty. So I took the whole bunch of them. There was old Bill McLean, he had two black eyes, and young Pat McLean and Gene McLean and the McDonalds and the McDougals and all of the rest of them. And all the younger generation hadn't got quite all the fight out of them yet, and we'd have to keep them apart, but the old ones, there's no trouble at all, they'd had all the fight that they wanted anyhow. So I waltzed them all over to this little Moran's office over there. Well, we couldn't get them into his printing shop where we were working over there part-time. I'd always work there like on Saturdays or spare time. I couldn't get them All in but part were outdoors, and Moran began to pace the floor. How was that going to look in print? The most respectable families in the whole country. To see that in print, he'd be worrying about the printing of this here fight, you know. Well, Bill McLean, he had two eyes as black, he couldn't see out. He says, "Your Honor, could I suggest something?" He says, Moran was pacing back and forth, "Suggest something, suggest something." He says, "We don't know how this fight started." He says, "We don't know. We think we got a little exuberant," he says, "and probably somebody hit the other one, and that's the way it started." Well, Moran says, last he looked, "Annis," he says, "you ought to know better," he says, "an Irishman, to stop a nice little battle like this on St. Patrick Day, you shouldn't have interfered. You should have let him fight it out." Well, they said, "Well, what are we going to do?" Well, he says, "I'll make it an order of the court," he says, "that each one go back to the bar and buy one drink." Well, there's about 60, that'd be 60 drinks. And with what they had there, the most would be asleep by that time. And he says, "I'll go to see this carried out, because he's the one that likes his drinks as well as the rest of them." Well, I says, "What about me?" "Well, Ennis, you're excused. That's eccentric." So I went on with the cream, and he went back, and here those fellows had been fighting and pulling and tugging a few minutes before all went back for another drink, and I guess that's the way we had justice, but I guess it's a good way to settle it, too. They'd been lawsuiting, yeah, then it got started, but that's the way.
What did the Irish do here?
Huh?
What did the Irish do here?
Well, they worked in the woods, they dug dishes, they did all of the work that any other of the pioneers did. Some of them were called square timber men. That is when they hewed out these holes. There were many big oak trees here. And they'd cut down these long oak trees, and then with their axes, they'd score them and take their broad axe and then make them into big square timbers. Maybe it'd be 18 inches square or 2 foot square and long timber. They use it for building ships. Ship timbers, what they called it. So a great number of them were ship timber men. They could hew logs. They were husky men, don't you see? And that's one of the things that they did. They dug ditches too, a lot of it by hand, right, with shovels too, and such work as that. And a few of them farmed. Not, I wouldn't say that any of them were any great farmers. They might have a few acres, but it's the Germans and the Polish and so on that came in that made the farms. But the old Irish and the Scots, they'd be more for the lumber woods and celebrating of all the days that they were to celebrate. There wasn't anything like that. It missed them, you know, in the early days, but they're a husky bunch of men.
Did Augrain have much to do with the White Pine lumbering?
Huh?
Did Augrain have much in the way of white
pine?
Oh,
yes.
Here before?
Yes. There were millions of feet. Millions and millions of feet went out of the Augrain. But that was all before, I'd say before 1895, along in the 80s and so on. As you see, the Augrain runs clear on up in by Hale, and Hale Lake and Sage Lake. That timber was brought down, the best of the pine was brought down in the, well, in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. But after that, there was still pine. The rivers were full of pine when I came here in 1896. Still, but it wasn't the best of it had been, and it was running into more cedar and pine and the poorer grades of timber has been. And then there's beginning to start on hardwood. Of course, you couldn't run hardwood down the rivers because that would sink. And if you had any hardwood, you'd have to have a cedar or something else to then put chain dogs to it, maybe to make it float and so on. But ash and such stuff as that, they did float some of that down. Hard maple, I never did know them to try to float that, that would sink some. But then the mills came in, they manufactured a lot of things, like the hardwoods is manufactured right here. I think that probably they made here at Augrain probably, oh, I'd say 100 million hooks. Millions and millions of hooks. Millions and millions of staves was manufactured. Headings for barrels, staves for barrels, hooks for barrels. And then there's thousands and thousands of telegraph poles and such things as that that came down the river. And then, of course, saw logs that used the ordinary timber was for saw log too, like ash and something that would float. They used that, but that wasn't to any great extent. It was, pine was the best, and that went out in the earlier days.
Did Did you know any of the mill owners? Were any of the mills still operating here?
No, not any mills now. Nothing after. We ended all the mills when they had the big fire in 1908. That finished the timber and that finished the mills. And that's why people left here. The old lumbermen, if they wanted to follow it, they had to go west or someplace else. There wasn't any more timber here after that.
Were you here when the fire?
Oh, yes. Like I said, I came here as a boy. I was only about 10 years old. So I was born in 87. And I came here in 96. So when I came here, and the river then was just, well, for miles and miles, 10, 15 miles, it'd be filled up with logs in the spring, and then they'd have to work those down out of the booms. At the mouth of the river, they had booms, you know. These logs would all be tangled up there, and then they would sort the, every log had some marks on the end. You've seen these old marks, and then they'd sort them out, and then each, like a WE, would be the Sage Land Improvement Company. When that log would come, where they'd put that in one slot, and then the different companies, and then they'd get them into big rafts, that is, maybe several thousand logs together, and then they'd put a big lot of boomsticks around. The tug would haul them out to Bay City or Saginaw and so on to the big sawmills there.
Were there any cutting mills here?
Oh, yes. Yes, there were. There were many mills here. One time there were about 14 or 15 mills here, but they weren't large mills like they had at Saginaw or Bay City.
Small local operations.
Yeah, small local operation, and that didn't have the large mill. I think it was on July the 4th, 1886, that I got in one of my stories. It was the first time in all of history that the saloons closed on Sunday. There were 14 saloons in this town alone at that time on Sunday, but that was quite an event for the saloons to close on Sunday, but they did, and there were 14 of them at that time. But at that time, most of the town was to the west of the, or to the east of the river. It was all along there is where, I've got pictures here, I could show you the old boom houses and booms and so on. But I've got all of those papers. Well, I think there must be some in here, but I've got hundreds of articles that I've written over the years. Well, as I said, I got in, as I was saying, I worked with Moran and there, and I got into kind of in the writing as a hobby. Well, later on, then the Aranac Independent employed me to go out as a newspaper reporter, and well, you'd get subscriptions and write news and so on. Well, then later on, the Gladwin County Record wanted me, so I worked a summer for the Gladwin County Record as a newspaper reporter. And I'd write stories and get pictures and so on there. Then the Lapeer County Press wanted me. There were two of Harry Myers' youngsters who just graduated from the University of Michigan. And the first article, I guess, they wrote when they got back was about the Farm Bureau. And most all the farmers, of course, were taking the paper. They wrote one article and lost 3,000 subscribers over the one article. So
when was that?
That is the Lapeer County Press.
When know. Was that?
Oh, that was back in the 30s, about 1934, somewhere along there, about that time. Well, then they asked me, Harry, of course, he had at one time, owned the Aranac Independent, wanted me to come down and see if I couldn't get them back. I said, Harry, it's going to cost you some money to get those back. So he gave me an unlimited an expense account, and I'd go to a bar on a rainy day and set them up in the honor of the Lapeer County Press and get them together, and eventually I did get the motion, but it took a lot of talking, you know. I'd go from one town.
It took a lot of talking, probably.
And I edited a full page, every week for the Lapeer County Press with pictures and so on. I just turned the stories in, and then fix them up there in the office, you know, but got them back eventually. Well, then later, why, then the Bay City Times, after I had 30 years in teaching back in 39. So the Bay City Times was, so I act as a roving reporter for Bay City Times from 39, 40, and 41 till the war came on, and I made up my mind I wouldn't look very good if we'd lose the war and say all I did was act as a newspaper reporter. So I quit and went and became military police down at Detroit. I was in World War One, you know, and served in the Navy during World War One. So I had quite a lot of experience so far as writing of newspaper articles and so on is considered.
Are you retired now?
Huh?
Are you retired now?
Oh yes, I've been retired for a good many years. Of course, I'm busier than ever, but I don't follow any one thing, you know. I was, for instance, 6 years on the road commission, and I was 10 years in the county. They used to call county commissioners of schools or county superintendents of schools, had charge of all the schools of the county, and like, well, mayor and little things like that, have held most all of those offices.
And when from was time, that, the county commissioner?
Huh?
When you were county commissioner of school?
I went in and from 1925 to 1935, had charge of all of the schools of Aranac County at that time. There were 42 school districts. See, the districts they didn't have any buses in those days, and they had the little one and two room schools and so on. Ran back in those days. So I still belong to all the educational associations, the National Education Association, the state, and state retired, and the national retired, and the Bay Aranac, and so on. I belong to all of those teachers' associations yet, and until very recently, I usually attended the meetings at the association, so I've always been wrapped up in education and so on.
Were you a member of the association from the beginning?
Oh, yes. They didn't have them as we have them now. I've had ever since, you might say, from 1909, as long as they've had them, I've been a member of all of the associations right along all of these years. But they didn't have, so far as I know of, the MEA and so on wasn't active way back like it is now, you see. It was. And those associations, anyhow, we didn't know it back in the horse and buggy days. Anyhow, we didn't know so much about it as we do today. So I've had quite a lot, but that's what I was thinking now with what we've gone through, that if we can get together, I know there's not many people that are historically minded, but if we could get something that they wanted, it would be there, and I thought Saginaw Valley College would be the place to make headquarters. It's some, no little easy thing to gather in all of the information, but we could get. I just got from Dr. Ethel Williams. She's the editor of Michigan Heritage. She just sent me a bulletin the other day. All of the counties, I know whether you folks have got it or not, the counties and townships of Michigan and their I was born. Yeah, there's weeks and weeks and weeks without a rain, and well, over in this swamp here, you know, you could shake and trees would all be afloat. But it got so hot that it caught the muck afire, and then the muck just dried out and it even burnt muck up and everything else there. That just lasted
like
for weeks.
Peat fire.
Yeah, well, it got that. Of course, it first went through the trees, but it was dry so long that I know that we were living up the river here. That's where I was living at the time, and we got on the banks of the river, and the fire went right on over us. We had buried everything, knew it was coming, smoke and so on, expecting everything to burn, but it just didn't happen to burn our house, and of course there was a few little clearing there, and the fire went on over us, and we were saved.
Was the town destroyed?
No, the fire didn't hit here. There was clearings around here. There was part of the town was destroyed in the fire of 1872 here. But this is the fire of 1908 that ruined the lumbering. Had fires all over the United States about the same time as Chicago burned, because I suppose it's a dry time everywhere and so on. But they had fires in Huron County and fires in other places and so on.
I understand the fire that burned in Michigan, in this area, in the valley here, in, I think it was 1908, the same year that Chicago burned, was a much greater fire and caused considerably more destruction than the Chicago fire did.
Well, as far as timber, it just ruined the timber. I was in a forest fire in 1912 up at Onondagan. I was up there one summer. My folks used to live up there. And it was in that fire, and it burned up, well, 8,000 cords of hemlock bark, and I don't know how many millions of feet of hemlock and pine, and there were 8 people burned, and they were shoved out to Lake Superior on the shore and so on. We were surrounded, And the only thing was, we were in a little stream and we just kept throwing that, and the water is coming right, the flames is right over us. But it commenced raining. That's the only thing that ever saved our lives. It was just that that rain came when it did, and I couldn't see for two or three days. We'd put tea in our eyes and so on. We couldn't get out there. Just a, you couldn't have got out of there after the fire. We was on a little island there. There was about 60 of us that bend in the river, and we kept that wet from this trout stream that we were there. That it saved our lives, but we couldn't have got out for two or three days if we wanted to, because there's so much fire that is everywhere burning, you know, these logs and coal and everything there, that they thought we were burned up, but we got out eventually.
Why did you put the tea in your eyes?
Huh?
Why did you put the tea in your eyes?
Well, that, if your eyes were all swollen shut from the smoke and so on, you could, there's no way of getting out of it, that strong smoke. Just the black smoke could be along the ground. And your throat was sore and everything else, and that's the only thing we had. We'd take tea and heavy, strong tea and pour it in our eyes, and helped it out a little bit as an astringent, I guess. We used that that time. Yeah, the forest fire, that ended the lumbering in this area here in 1908 is when the fire went through here in the fall of 1908. I've got that mentioned in some of my stories here. And
what sort of work have you been doing with the Indians here?
Well, I've interviewed a lot of the older Indians that know the language and traditions. I've worked with them. Well, for the last 60 years I've been with us. Of course, the younger ones don't know. It's just the same as younger generation here, you might say. A lot of people can't tell much about their ancestors, but there are some of the older ones that can, and those that can't. These right across this little girl that's here now is an Ojibwa. That's Ojibwas that lives there, and that next house down there is a Blackfoot from back there, and John, Annabelle's husband, he's a Cherokee, so that we're right in an Indian settlement right here now. The Cherokees and the Blackfeet and Ojibwas and so on are common here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been working, but now Leslie James, that's the one that I wanted to take you to see, his eyes has gone bad, and they put him in a rest home, and I haven't seen him since he's in the rest home. I don't know how bad.
Where is he now, Mr. Yance? Which nursing home?
What is it?
Which nursing home is he
at? At Sterling Nursing Home. That's what they told me. He's in the Sterling Nursing
Home. Is this a granddaughter over here, Dad?
I imagine that she's a relative. It's probably the granddad of him. Now, he always lived, his home was in Saguenay. And he wanted his children to have an education. So he moved to Detroit, and he never drank. This Leslie James never drank. And of course he went, in those days they used to, there was a place called Carlisle. The government sent him, they sent him out to Carlisle for some education. Usually they learned a trade. And then after he got back from Carlisle, why, he went through this Ford Trade School. He went through Henry Ford at a trade school, and he went through that. Well, then he became a ball player, and he played professional baseball and made a lot of money in that. Well, as I said, he never drank, and fact is, he's got apartment houses. He says a whole row of them in Detroit, but he don't care any more about those apartment houses. He says his wife and wife's relatives can run them. She don't care anything about them. He said, just as an example, he said in the Depression, there was a line of men a mile long were trying to get work. And after he got up a little closer in the line, he could see they had another line that says for professional help only. And all of a sudden he jumped out of this line and he gets over in this other short line. There weren't very many into it. Says, come back, you Indian, you don't belong in that line. Well, the fact was that he'd gone through Ford's trade school, so he got up there and the fellow says, do you know anything about running this? I think so, he says, I think so. And there was only six or seven of the interviewed. Well, it says that they're quitting. We've got to have a foreman for this department. He says, have you got anybody? Could you run those machines in there? He says, get me the blueprints. And they got him the blueprints. And he looked it over, looked the blueprints over. He says, I think I can. He says, would you like to have me take it? And he just took from this blueprint, he put his stock in the machine, he says, and ran out apiece, now get your inspector here, see if it's made right. Inspector couldn't find anything about it, and then he'd go to the next machine, get the blueprint, see it like that, and set it up, and well, he says, I guess you're qualified to be foreman. Well, 35 women was employed, and they didn't want to work under an Indian. He said they were prejudiced about working with under an Indian. He says, I won't bother you. He said, if you have any trouble with your machine, just let me know and I'll fix it up and so on. So he got along for two or three years there, and he worked right along, got along well there, and he knew his stuff so far as that. But then he was living at the time in a little bit of a shack, oh, about as big as this part of the room, just big enough for a bed here and a little stove, and he said he preferred that, and I guess he's right about it, to all of those apartment houses in the rush and hurry in the city. Had his great-grandfather's old fish spear that they had, and he says a little hunting and fishing and good enough for him, and so I guess his eyesight. So I used to take him out ahead. I took him down like to Kaukau and different places for dinner and so on. Well, he's always telling me the Indian name, and one day I was out with him, and I said, well, I'd like to learn five colors today. You know, it's so hard to pronounce these Indian names, they're difficult. See, they have so many sounds that doesn't exist at all in the English language. And then there's not any R sound at all. That doesn't exist. And then they have other sounds that we've never heard. But anyhow, when we got along, we got to green. He says, we don't have green in our language. I said, do you mean to tell me as common a thing as green is that you don't have it in the... He says, we don't have it as adjectives. He's educated enough that he says, we don't use it as adjectives. We use it as nouns and so on, but we don't use it like green grass or a green tree. He says, a little Indian child that has never heard the English language go to school and they ask him, talk about the green grass or green leaves, he won't know what you're talking about because he's never heard it in that way. So you can see how teachers and teaching foreign languages and so on can get off. Mm-hmm. And he says, then I kind of doubted it. We went over to another England family and he verified it. He says, it's very seldom used, he says. They use it right along as a, in connection with a word, if it's like a green bird or something like that, but not like as a green leaf or something like that. It's not as an adjective, but more often as some of the other parts of speech, don't you see? So that, then I know one day he says, well, now these, all of these dishes are noggins. He says, any bowl or dish is a noggin in Chippewa or Ojibwa. Of course, that isn't the way they don't call themselves. That's the name that Schoolcraft or somebody else gave. Chippewa and Ojibwa and so on. That isn't what they call themselves, but that's some of the things that the white man called, and he usually gets it wrong. For instance, you've got down there Chesaning, and that doesn't exist. They left out the K-I sound. There's a K-I, and they left, white man's left that off because he could never hear that. And there's a K-I that should be on the beginning of that word, but...
What would it sound like?
Well, it's the same sound, but it's so much lower. They can hear so much better than we can. So much lower, we don't hear the K-I, so it's Kai Chesaning, which means a big rock or stone, which was, must have been a big rock or stone there. That's why they called it that, but that wasn't, we don't hear that, don't you see?
What do you think of Schoolcraft?
Well, I tell you what, I think that he's ruined Michigan history if he would have left anything alone. But look at his naming of the county. He'd always had to put some euphonious name onto it. That is the trouble with Henry Rouse Schoolcraft. I've read the most of his works. And
the big chief and the pioneer.
If they would have, if he had just left it to his wife. Now, his wife was an educated woman.
Was she better? Better than he?
Well, she was the granddaughter of one of the Indian chiefs, is what she was. His wife was educated in that, but he didn't use it. Now, for instance, Alpena. If he left the al off and said pina, then it'd be bird or something. That's a small bird is pina. Panacea would be a large bird. If it's a young bird, they have three ways that they say it, don't you see? But he'd have to put an al to it. And most everything else that he'd do, he'd put something else to it to make it sound maybe Greek or some other language. And for that reason, that most of the counties that he named, they've taken it off the list. That, yeah, I know.
Did you tell them, Mr. Ennis, how it was that you came to hear that genealogy?